Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
The rare joy of carbon copy screamers. What £6 million buys you in today's transfer market? The very precise rhythm of the announcement of added time. The dying art of strikers rounding the goalkeeper. The single most annoying low-key thing a fourth official does. Cameramen in players' faces. And the empty, seemingly eternal last 5 minutes of a half-time break. Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés and your Mesut Haaland Dix. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 199 of Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry and with me for the adjudication panel slash the listeners MHD for October is David Walker and Nick Miller. How are you both?
Yeah, not bad. Not bad at all.
I think it went swimmingly last time, Dave, and I'm glad we're doing it again. I realise some people will notice that it's in quick succession, but this is the only available slot for October. I'm really happy that we're going to make this a monthly thing. So this is the October's listeners, Mesut Haaland Dix. It's a great selection again.
Yeah, it was a roaring success last time. Went down very well with the masses. So here they are again.
Giving them a voice. We're not going to give them a voice just yet because it's time for the adjudication panel. A few things to run through first. I want to run this one past you, just to make sure I was dead on with this. Luke Smith tweeted me with regards to Gabriel Martinelli's 58th second goal against Liverpool, reported by the Daily Mail as capping off a fine display. You can't cap off a display with a goal scored in the first minute, can you? Your shaking of the head already is reassuring me. It's a simple Nick, but it's, I think it's also quite important. And lots of people were replying saying, well, I mean, you know, what did it do then? You know, what did it do? And I said, well, you just don't have to use it. It's simple as that. You just don't have to say it capped off at a performance. Simple as that.
That's a roaring start, isn't it? Surely. A capping off, as I'm sure you've covered, is a goal towards the end of the game of a fine individual performance.
Absolutely. It's, you know, not a capping off when you see it, Dave, don't you?
It heralded what was to be
there's
a fine
no word
performance.
For it. Don't even try. Don't go for heralded. Don't go for, you know, prescient, anything like that. None of it works. It just happened and then he played well. That's simple as that. There's nothing. Football needs a word for it, but it hasn't got one yet. Maybe Susie Dent will find one. Right. I really enjoyed this from listener Paul, who was listening to Charlton versus Exeter on Radio Devon. Now, this bit of commentary starts off quite surreal and then ends just superbly.
The North Stand there, James, and I've just seen, is that a full moon tonight? I think it is a full moon, isn't it? It just looks great, just hovering above the North Stand there.
Yeah, it's fantastic full moon on a Tuesday night here in London.
Do you think they're watching on the moon? You never know. You never know what's out there.
Well, if they did, they saw a goal worthy of any planet today.
And here comes another shot, this time from Collins. It bounces up.
A goal worthy of any planet. That really capped it off, actually, for me, Dave. I thought it was lovely. A goal worthy of any planet.
Of any of them. In the whole galaxy.
I was going to raise this on Tuesday's adjudication panel, Nick. The concept of a goal worthy of. I think I heard it during Match of the Day last weekend, sort of goal worthy of winning this match. I'm quite sick of goals worthy of. I think it's complete nonsense. No goal has to be worthy of anything. The uglier the better, as far as I'm concerned.
I kind of associate goal worthy of the occasion, like a final or something like that. Someone scores a screamer in the FA Cup final or Champions League or whatever. But yeah, I think... I'd accept it more in that case rather than, as you say, just a winning goal in a game.
Yeah, okay, I'm happy to allow showpiece events, but I will not have goals considered worthy of simply winning a game. A goal worthy of equalising, Dave. Would you have that?
Absolutely not.
No. Dreadful.
Also, moon not a planet, is it? Is the moon? The moon's not a planet.
Well, it's
the
moon.
The football was taking place on the Earth.
Yes.
Yeah. And the observer was on the moon looking down. So, I
mean... good point.
I will accept this one-off usage because it is absolutely lovely. So
the International Space Station zooming in on the valley. Might be a Charlton fan up there. Who knows?
I can see a football game from the International Space Station. Get your Hubble out for the lads. Right. before we get into it, Mesut Haaland-Dix, it's time for My Sins Corner because we're on a real roll with this. You two have so finely tuned to the art of For My Sinsing. And so I want to unleash this effort from Pointless on BBC One last week. Just to recap on the rules, because some people, like John Ashley, need them clarified. John, Nick, thought that you technically and morally won For My Sins the other day because your For My Sins was closer to the actual uttering of For My Sins. I had to point out to John Ashley that Dave got there first and it was so clearly and definitively for that moment of the clip. He didn't go too well. It couldn't possibly have been a For My Sins for any other part of the clip. So
we're not trying to overlay our For My Sins with the For My Sins. We are trying to predict the For My Sins.
Agreed. Yes, predicting, not timing.
I'd really love to kick up an undignified stink about how I've been cheated out of this, but yeah, it was a fair cop.
Yep.
Dave beat me to it by mere second.
Good for you.
Am I in a similar vein to the football cliches quiz, which will be returning in a few weeks' time?
Mm.
Michael Cox, the champion of that particular title. Am I the champion? Is it a champion situation? Or what's the... I mean, possession?
I don't consider it such a grand thing. It's just like winner stays on a game of table tennis or something like that. It's not a big deal. Don't got to start bragging about it in your wider life. That's all I would say. Imagine explaining that. Anyway, enough preamble. It's time for For My Sins Corner. Let's do it.
But before we get an answer from you, tell us a bit more about Drew.
So, like Dan, I'm a copywriter, also a massive sports fan, and a long-suffering Arsenal fan.
Suffering a bit less now, though, at time of filming.
Yeah, just, you know, the glory days, long ago.
I was once in a cab, this cab driver, he was talking about football, and I asked him who he supported. He said, I support Spurs.
For my sins.
He said, for my sins? I laughed, thinking, well, yeah, and he started crying.
Wow.
A twist.
Superb from Nick. Justified. A call worthy of winning any For My Sins Corner.
Well done. No, yeah. I give you that. I didn't see that coming because I was surprised because it was straight out the gate into the football chat with the contestant, which, and I didn't see Xander being the man who did the For My Sinsing, but yeah, well done.
Yeah.
I had to, there's a degree of nerve holding because obviously you were aware this was going to be more quick fire than Ken Bruce, but I'm delighted with how I played that game.
You did. I think really announcing yourself on the global For My Sins stage with that performance.
It's capped off a fine performance from me.
One point just to bring up. Does it count if you're retelling a story?
Yes.
It's not quite a traditional For My Sins, is it?
Look, I took my defeat in good spirit in the last edition, and I think you need to do so in this one as well. So.
Nothing against you, Nick. More of an issue with the source material.
Oh, I'm sure John Ashley will have something to say about this and all the other For My Sins Corner pedants, the people who didn't make the rules and had never even considered the concept until I brought it to their ears. Right, enough of all that nonsense. It's time for Mesut Haaland-Dix with you, the listeners, for October. Kicking off our first love, this is from Yoni Gordon-Teller.
My football love is the same player scoring two screamers of an almost identical nature in the same game. I discovered I loved this when Laurent Robert did it for Newcastle against Spurs in December 2003, and it's only enhanced by the mix of smugness and surprise on the goalscorer's face when they realise what has happened.
At first, Dave, I thought this is a great shout. There are going to be so many examples of this that we can enjoy. You know, loads of similarly carbon copy wonder goals in the same game by the same player. It's the sort of thing my brain could easily come up with three instant examples of, but I can't think of any at all.
Me neither. I know.
The mind really plays tricks with this, Nick. I thought, I was thinking of Mario Stanic's debut for Chelsea. I thought he might have hit identical volleys. No, one was a header. That completely played with mine. I thought Paolo Di Canio did it for West Ham against Chelsea in the early 2000s. That didn't happen either. I'm a bit stumped by this. Maybe Gareth Bale versus Inter, but were they wonder goals or just simply carbon copies? All three were left-footed rifles into the bottom right corner, right?
Well, yeah, I don't think, strictly speaking, the Gareth Bale goals against Inter Milan were wonder goals, but they sort of have taken on that mantle. Like, it was the breakthrough of performance. It was the occasion, a goal worthy of the occasion.
Yeah, it feels like athleticism is never really kind of entered into the equation of wonder goals. It's either sort of technique of strike, but that's a debate for another time. It wasn't quite as triumphant as the Laurent Robert example we've been given here. But let's assess this example, Dave, seeing as it's the only one we've got. Now, the goals are similar-ish. One's a kind of thumping first-time volley with Laurent Robert's famed left foot. The other one is just simply a screamer from the left-hand side of the pitch. So they're not really identical. But what is very similar is the commentary.
Now the shot comes in from Robert. Oh!
Now Robert again. Shoots.
Right.
So they get roughly the same kind of, oh, Nick. So that's fine, isn't it? That basically seals the deal as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, the second one was slightly more guttural, I think, the second O. I sort of had planted it in my head that they were two identical goals as well.
Yeah. Not identical.
No, they're not. No,
but they're
one's
not.
A volley.
Yeah.
Just two very, very good goals, which I think is probably what Yoni Gordon-Teller is really aiming for here. They'd have to be identical because you're completely narrowing the field. So,
and which is good. That widens our parameters here, which now means I can cite the example that came to mind initially. Yeah. And that was Kevin De Bruyne at the Emirates two seasons ago. I think in the season that went on to become the lockdown one, so there were 19-20 season, he nearly scored a third, and they were all great finishes, and he hit the third and he hit the post. It would have been an amazing hat trick. That's my most recent example that
Nick, I'm convinced that this phenomenon exists. I mean, I'm sure people are going to send loads in examples of this sort of thing happening, but as a footballing spectacle, I think it's really nice. This is the idea of it. This is kind of, well, he's done it once and the other team just have no idea how to deal with it, so he's just done it again. Absolutely brilliant. I'll tell you what, another little technical issue here: free kicks don't count, cheating, not having sort of a couple of free kicks pinged into the same top corner, doesn't care.
I thought of this as well. Leo Messi's done this a couple of times where he's pinged in a couple of free kicks into roughly the same position, and yeah, I agree, it is sort of cheating. When we were discussing this yesterday, I said I'll try and think of an example. You said Ian Wone must have done it. I don't think he did, but I did sort of reach back into my Forest supporting childhood, and Stan Collymore had one game quite early on in his Forest career where he did that thing where when there's like a phenomenon of a player who's not many people know much about yet, and defenders have absolutely no idea how to deal with them, like Roberto Ayala with Michael Owen in the 98 World Cup, just hadn't got a clue.
The ludicrously deep Roberto Ayala. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the West Brom defence did this with Stan Collymore. It was a little bit... Collymore scored two goals where he was running through the West Brom defence and they all looked like kids when an adult joins in a playground game or something like that. Just kind of everyone, all these seemingly little boys running around in different directions, being completely unable to stop what's happening in front of them. So as much as I would love Ian Wone to have done it, I don't think he did, but Stan Collymore did.
Yeah, I mean, I would happily have the rest of this podcast dedicated to players we think may have scored identical wonder goals in the same game. Ian Wone would be right at the top of that list. I'm sure they exist. Please do send me examples of players scoring identical wonder goals in the same game, because I'm convinced that this phenomenon is bigger than our collective brains can imagine. The next love comes from Niall Murta, and I really like this one. It's a very precise valuation.
My footballing love is a £6 million player. Now, if a player's about to go out of contract in the Premier League, often you can snap him up for £6 million in the January window. That's always quite an exciting piece of business. But in the Championship, it's never the most expensive fee you pay, but it's a price that shows you're firmly in the promotion hunt. The most £6 million player, in my opinion, Austrian goal machine Andreas Weimann.
I think he's pitched this really well, Nick. I mean, we are We are in it deep into an era of overinflated transfer fees. And we've talked about the desensitisation to mammoth transfer fees on this podcast before. But £6 million still should be a significant amount of money to spend on a football player. And I think he's pitched this well. £6 million is what £2.5 million used to be. It's still a solid amount. Not something you just throw away, but it's still a certain, very specific type of player, I think. And Andreas Weidmann is a good shout to kind of yardstick this, I think.
Yeah, I think Weidmann's a good shout because I think £6 million is the perfect price for the too good for the Championship, not quite good enough for the the Premier League striker. Yes. So I think Lewis Grabban cost £6 million last time when Forrest bought him a few years ago. I imagine Cameron Jerome has cost £6 million at some point.
We'll get into some specific examples in a minute. Dave, who feels very £6 million-y to you these days? Who do you think? If you had £6 million in your pocket, who are you snapping up?
I find it quite difficult, actually, to sort of keep up with sort of benchmarking in the transfer market because and I think this is probably a thing like your favourite World Cup is the one that you watched when you were 12 or whatever. Right. And like in my head, when I first started becoming aware of like transfer fees and stuff, it was like when Watford were, the archetypal selling club in the Championship, they would have a striker who scored 20 goals and he would be sold, no questions asked, and it would be like Heide Helgson going for like 3 million or Danny Graham going for 3.5 million. So, yeah. That seemed like a really good sum of money to get. That was a really big deal for us. And so 6 million to me still sort of, in one sense, feels like quite a lot of money. But then on the flip side, you see like, I don't know, Wolves sign, who was that defender? Nathan Collins from Burnley for like £20 million.
That's the going rate for a centre-half
And it just sort of, when I see it initially, it sort of fries my brain a little bit. Mm. And I think, what, £20 million for him?
Yeah.
But then you sort of think, oh, well, yeah, but, you know, the top end is that and it drags it all up. So it is all a bit mad. But
it's
like,
a very good season so far, actually, Dave, I'll have you know.
Yeah. Well, I've just had a look on the sort of done deals page for like the most recent transfer window.
Mm.
And Southampton signed Juan Larios for £6 million from Manchester City.
Yeah, it feels quite... That 6 million... Okay, this is a very specific genre of the 6 million... pound player. It's the kind of snapping up from a big club. They don't really need him anymore, but still clearly a bit of potential there. Like that's
Billy Gilmore was £7.5 million.
Yeah.
So that's sort of similarish sort of price bracket. And I think, but as Niall correctly said, the complexion completely changes if you are, if you're signing a player for 6 million in the Championship, that's a statement, I think. Well, maybe not. You're getting into statement territory, but you could possibly spend a bit more money at the top end of the Championship.
Yeah,
but,
to pick up on Niall's point about a £6 million deal kind of signalling ambition, that really can only be the case in the Championship. Only one player moved for £6 million in the Championship. That was John Swift from Reading to West Brom. That's kind of £6 million territory. Mm. I mean, £6 million really is the kind of upper limit you can really be spending these days in the Championship to kind of make a statement. Nick, over in the Premier League, things get a little bit more underwhelming. Cameron Carter-Vickers from Spurs to Celtic for £6.3 million. Again, it's kind of a kind of kick-starty career type of fee, isn't it?
It also feels like that was... I like that example because £6 million also feels like the sort of upper limit for Scotland. Like
yes.
The Scottish transfer record is still Torre-Andre Flo from about 20 years ago, which is about £12 million. So in these straightened times, £6 million feels like a bit of a statement for Rangers or Celtic. In the Premier League, it feels like a kind of... It's a whisper it quietly transfer. Like Joe Aribo, right, went from Rangers to Southampton for £6 million. So it feels like a kind of whisper it quietly, but at £6 million, Joe Aribo could be a really good pickup for Southampton.
I was going to say pickup. Quite a smart pickup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Shrewd. What's the maximum amount of money a shrewd transfer can be? I mean, I suppose it could be anywhere, anything up to £25 million if you're getting someone really on the relative cheap.
Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. Shrewd. It depends on the context of the player, where they're coming from, what the sort of, if there's any sort of buyout clauses and all that nonsense. Because I think I've seen Haaland described in some quarters as like, tell you what, I mean, that's Manchester City have really got him for a steal there. I mean, what was it like? Was it 17 million?
It's the most labyrinthine transfer I've ever seen. Nobody knows how much Erling Haaland costs.
It's very important not to definitively say he costs so much, because you will get someone saying, oh, well, actually, if you factor in the...
And you've got to do amortisation these days. So really, I mean, it's all a load of bollocks.
Amortisation.
You've got to factor in the fee to his dad and the agency and all this. So actually, it wasn't that cheap.
And the upkeep of the robotics inside him, of course.
The WD-40, you've got to factor that in as well.
Yeah, you know, despite all this meandering chat about £6 million-y players, I still feel like Lewis Graben out there with Al Ahly in Saudi Arabia is still has another £6 million move in him. Where's he going, though? Where's he going?
Back to Bournemouth?
He's already been to Norwich as well. Yeah, back to Bournemouth. That'd be fine. That would be just fine. Next up, a familiar voice for some of you. Here's Matt Davis-Adams, host of the Athletic's Chelsea podcast, straight out of Cobham.
Hey guys, one of the things that I love about football is the announcement for how much stoppage time there's going to be when done using the correct vernacular cadence and timbre. It should sound like this. The fourth official has indicated there will be a minimum of 4 minutes added time. 4 minutes. If you can guess the correct number of minutes, even better. Either way, it sounds beautiful.
Now, Dave, Matt's nailed this. He's nailed the rhythm as he outlined first. I wanted a little bit more gusto from him, actually. I wanted some real kind of oomph from it. But he's nailed the time moving it absolutely right, to the point where I wonder if this is like a directive from the authorities, Dave, about how stadium announcers should announce the amount of added time.
I've not thought about that, actually. I do like it when sometimes there's a very slight dramatic pause. If it's like
where
a big number, so you might get the fourth official has indicated there'll be a minimum of 7 minutes added time.
I don't think the pause is sanctioned by the top authorities. You can't be pausing for dramatic effect. Sort of thing the Manchester City stadium would do.
He's doing it like Dermot O'Leary on X Factor, pausing for 30 seconds.
When thinking about this in my head, and once again, Matt has absolutely nailed the rhythm of this. And I was trying to think, I don't think many voices of stadium announcers are familiar to me, except maybe the Anfield or Goodison ones. I can't remember which one it is, but that seems to me to scream kind of...
The guy at Anfield's been doing it for like 50 years or something. Mm. I'm sure we've done a piece with him. He's
got such a stadium announcery voice. Mm. It's perfect. The fourth official has indicated there will be a minimum of 4 minutes added time. 4 minutes. It's just the right, because he's got some good bass to his voice, isn't he?
Yeah. Is there a difference with the cadence used in the first half to announce that added time?
I mean, it feels less dramatic, but I don't know. I'm not sure if there is the difference in cadence. No, it's got a similar vibe, but...
I would say that the stadium announcer is definitely aware of the context, which would make me think that the second half one is definitely delivered with a little bit more like, So it's like five.
It's the big moment. It's the big moment for them.
Oh, it's huge, because you know you're going to get a...
What?
This is the other thing. What's
Where'd
the
you get that from?
Yeah, well, but what's the number of minutes where there's no reaction? Because it feels like, I don't know, I think it feels like three... Because one or two feels like there's not enough, but anything from four and above is very much where's he got that from, and I know it kind of depends on, you know, whether the home team is in front or whatever, but it just feels like there's always a reaction to it, whether it's too much or too little.
I once drew up a graph of injury time minutes against incredulity of sound in reaction, and I can tell you it really does leap. From four to five.
Sounds like something that is absolutely ripe to be recycled for your new Friday column, to me.
Already been in the book, so...
no one's checking.
Yeah, can't plagiarise yourself, can you? Well, you can, actually. Anyway, no complaints with the timing of that. Do you want a little bit more oomph, Matt, next time, if possible? Right, Andrew Brown is next up. I never thought of this as a dying art, but now I really do think it is. David Attenborough needs to get on the case.
My football love is when forwards, and specifically number nines, score one-on-ones by taking it around the keeper. I really associate with the 90s and the early noughties, the likes of Ronaldo, young Michael Owen, and other speedy strikers. When they slip through on goal, bearing down on the keeper, they do a step over or a shimmy, sit the keeper down, and then slip the ball into an empty net. I feel like we don't see very much of it at all these days. And for me, this is what I want to see from Haaland to take his game to the next level.
It's a really interesting one, Nick. And before we get into the potential nuts and bolts of this, do you agree? Do you think that taking the ball round the goalkeeper is a dying art? I'm inclined to say yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure if you talk to the right people, there is some kind of reason for it.
I think it's a fascinating subject. I think data should be used to analyse this, because I'm convinced it's the case.
But yeah, it's definitely one of those things that I hadn't really considered, or hadn't really thought, whatever happened to taking it around the goalkeeper?
Yeah.
But now Andrew's brought it up, I can't think of a recent example.
Dave, can you think of a single reason why this might be the case?
Is it, I mean, it is more risky, I think, isn't it? It's quite, and you are at risk of making yourself look silly.
Mm.
If you've got a one-on-one opportunity and you decide to take it round the keeper and the keeper just stops the ball at your feet, or God forbid you go round the keeper and you miss, which is what Watford's Yasser Asprilla did in the recent home game against Swansea. Took it round the keeper very skillfully and sort of fluffed the finish and a defender cleared it off the line. But
90s name, 90s approach.
Exactly, so, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But this is something that Dotun Adebayo brought up when he did his Mesut Haaland dicks, when he was talking about Ronaldo, Brazilian Ronaldo, and his ability to step up, you know, use the step over to take the ball around the keeper, which is
don't see that goal at all anymore. It wasn't outlandish. I mean, it's been done a lot, but I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw it happen.
The other thing that maybe we don't see this anymore is when strikers are in that scenario and they decide to try and take it around the keeper, is actually their instinct is to leave the leg in and get fouled for the penalty.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Has finishing got better, Nick? I don't think it's up for debate that trying to slot it past the keeper is a more straightforward way of doing this. Not that I'm suggesting that players in the past were over-engineering the situation either. So maybe it's just like finishing's just got better, pitches are better, and it's easier to slide the ball past the goalkeeper.
Have goalkeepers got better as well? Because the goalkeepers used to sell themselves more readily.
Yeah,
in those
figured it. Yeah,
there's a nice subgenre of this was I think you kind of think of the classic one is. The striker goes round the keeper who tries to sort of clamber after it with their hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they're kind of crawling along the floor. Like
early man.
Yeah, like they're pretending to be a dog or something. But a nice sub-genre of it is when the striker sells the keeper and the keeper goes the wrong way. Mm. He just kind of falls over to the left as Ronaldo goes round to the right.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But it's maybe you're kind of right that it's a sort of being considered as a very like high risk but high tariff maneuver, because Fernando Torres had two, so that miss against Manchester United where he missed an open goal I think it was quite early on in his Chelsea career, that's that he took it around the goalkeeper after that, and then of course the one in Barcelona,
yeah,
where he took it around the goalkeeper. And
even watching it back now, you think, I don't trust him. I wouldn't trust him to do it. I wouldn't back him at that moment. So, but yeah, Dave, all right, you're through on goal and you've committed yourself to taking it around the goalkeeper. What's your go-to technique in your head?
I would like to drop a shoulder. You know, no step overs. I just want to almost faint that I am going to maybe dink it, but then you just do a little touch around the keeper and then
slot it home. Where are you going, left or right?
I can imagine,
are you going with your instep or outside?
I'm taking it round the keeper with the outside of my right boot.
Okay.
You see?
Important to get the touch right. You've got to control the angle.
And that's something I can remember as the example said. I can remember Michael Owen doing that quite a bit. I think it feels Michael Owen-y to me.
Yeah, it does feel quite Michael Owen-y. Especially if you're feeling particularly ambitious, Nick, you could attempt the runaround move, the Pelé runaround move, which has its own Wikipedia page. Sort of nick it one side or even just let the ball go and then run round the other. But you wouldn't see that these days, would you? Nonsense.
No, far too flamboyant. Another subgenre I quite like is when it looks like the striker's taken the ball too far and the angle is too tight, and then he sort of gets it in from the tightest of angles.
Yeah.
I'm thinking Mark Hughes in the 91 Cup Winners' Cup final.
I suppose there are situations, you do kind of get these situations where the ball's running through in the sort of channel and the keeper's coming out and the player nicks it past him and then converts from a narrow angle. That's not taking around the keeper, is it? We can't have that.
It's not the same. Not
it's not the same,
is it?
It's beating them to the ball and then scoring from a narrow angle. It's not really going round them. It's not by design. It's just like that was the only way to do it.
Hmm.
I'm convinced of this. I'm, I'm not sure how on earth I'm going to get the data to prove it, but I bloody well
another
will.
Another big long Y Scout session coming up for you.
Looking forward to that. Right, thanks, Andrew Brown. Excellent stuff. The final love for this one is from Connor Whitley.
My fascination with football is whenever a player is on the fringes of their team and goes out on loan, they are always described as at the age where they need to play games, no matter how old they are. They're in their teens or their early 20s, they have to go and get the experience. If they're in their mid or their late 20s, or at their peak, they can't waste it. And if they're in their 30s, there's no point in being on the bench at that age.
This is a very good point, Dave. Mm. This is a kind of the kind of words he offers here are a kind of close cousin from of when a player says, well, I need to be playing regular football at this stage of my career. And I always think, at what stage of football do you not need to be? Because, I mean, especially these days, youngsters are knocking on the door demanding first team football. Is there any particular age where you think it wouldn't apply?
No, I think all of those examples are completely spot on. Of all of them, the least one, I suppose, is the peak years, just because we probably don't hear that much because the situation tends to have been sorted out by that point. Yeah. They will have left. They will have made sure that they've found a secure club by their peak years. But nevertheless, the example still would make sense. It does. It's a great point.
I guess, Dave, you kind of also hear it from players coming back from injury and they're not back in the team yet and they just need to go somewhere to get some games under their belt. Get 30 or 40 games somewhere. It's all fairly logical, very healthy thing for a professional footballer to want to play football. So maybe that's why. Maybe that's why it applies universally. Interesting one from Connor Whitley. Right, if you want to scream your loves and hates of football directly at our human faces, you can see us at London's Earth on the 8th of November, Manchester's New Century Hall on the 15th of November, or Dublin's Liberty Hall Theatre on the 16th of November. If you want tickets for that, just go to myticket.co.uk or just Google Football Clichés Live. Tickets are going like actual hotcakes now, Dave. So,
like actual hotcakes?
Yes, they are going.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
So, get them while you can.
Get them while indeed you can.
Would you like to be the fountain of football knowledge within your friendship group, either down the pub or in the group chat? Because if so, the Athletic Football Tactics podcast is surely the podcast for you. I'm Ali Maxwell, and every week the Athletic's tactics guru Michael Cox, its data whiz Mark Carey, and myself take a tactical deep dive into the week's biggest talking points. This week, we'll be assessing the ever-changing role of the modern number nine and wondering if it's having a renaissance, and if so, how Erling Haaland, Darwin Nunez and Gabriel Jesus's big summer moves have shaped that conversation. We're also taking a look at Manchester City against Liverpool and asking if this is still the biggest fixture that the Premier League has to offer or not. Make sure to check out our back catalogue too, 3 years worth of episodes featuring more nostalgic lookbacks at iconic teams and seasons from yesteryear, like Carlo Ancelotti's Christmas tree formation at AC Milan or Mesut Ozil's Arsenal legacy. It's good fun and the experts bring a ton of insight. So join us. Just search for the Athletic Football Tactics podcast wherever you get your podcasts and make sure to follow and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Oh, look at that! That is wonderful!
Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés.
Right, welcome back to Mesut Haaland Dicks with you, the listeners, for October. Let's get into the hates now. Some lovely selections here. First one comes from Stuart Levy.
What annoys me is the concept of minutes. So, for example, you hear people say, last season player X played 1,000 minutes, or player Y is on a 400-minute goal drought. You know what? What do these actually mean? Just tell me he's on an 8-game goal drought, or last year he played 10 matches. I don't want to have to be always dividing everything by 90 minutes in my head.
I feel like there's a potential here, Nick, for us to get a very proper football man about this. This does sound slightly like the sort of thing that Keijan Gray would get annoyed about on a quiet Sunday afternoon. They're measuring it in minutes, Andy. Minutes.
It feels more like the kind of thing that one of them would, like, at halftime of a really exciting game, they would just go off on this for no particular reason. Though, and you should be talking about the many exciting moments in that game, but they're going on about minutes. I confess I can't get too annoyed about this. I'm not really sure what the issue is.
It's not that it's annoying, Dave. I think it's just that after a certain point, you start to not be able to really get the scale of this sort of thing about whether it is bad that player hasn't scored for that long. But I will make an exception for collective... I will make an exception for the length of time that a team hasn't conceded a goal for. If it goes into like 10 hours, that to me is emphatic. I can't do the maths on it particularly quickly, but it's evocative. If a team hasn't scored for 10 hours, I'm like, wow, that's a shitload of time.
Exactly. It's always clean sheets, isn't it?
Half a day.
It's always like Petr Cech has equaled the record set by David James and not conceded a goal for 11 hours, 27 minutes and 46 seconds or whatever it may be. And it's just sort of, does that sound more impressive than, what is that in games? Like, is it 11 games or whatever it is? I can't do the maths.
We just look stupid. We look utterly stupid here. We've been completely duped by this one just to make ourselves look utterly ridiculous.
But then also on the flip side, so that's an example where people will use minutes and hours to emphasise the impressiveness of a particular achievement. But then where the other side where you hear it quite a lot now, and it takes my brain a few seconds to sort of tune in to whether that's a good or a bad thing, is when, for example, on like the tactics podcast that we have, when people are talking about, oh, well, he only played 1,000 minutes last season, so that's a small sample size. And I'm like, 1,000 minutes? How many? Oh, yeah, what is that? It's probably only 10 games or something. Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, I'm trying to pin down here, Nick, is where we draw the line with this sort of stuff. Or what if a player makes kind of like four kind of regulation appearances from the substitutes bench? Can we then say he's had 2 hours this season to impress Manager X? That wouldn't work at all. I can't have that.
I mean, do you think that there are, like, appearance bonuses are sort of measured on this these days as well? Like, you know, you go... Once you're hitting a certain number of minutes, then your bonuses start kicking in instead of the classic old, just if you're on the pitch, you get your appearance bonus.
One thing I do disagree with Stuart here, Dave, is that, you know, if you start going into sort of starts and sub-appearances, it's all a bit clunky, isn't it? Maybe minutes just does the job. What about per 90? How do you feel about per 90? Can be very convenient stat, can't it?
Exactly, yeah. I don't necessarily mind it, but... I do agree with Stuart, really. I prefer it. I prefer a nice goals and games, starts, all that stuff. I prefer that to minutes.
Fine.
Minutes has also become the sort of a kind of slightly amorphous concept that kind of ties in with the going out on loan thing. You go out on loan to get minutes under your belt.
Get minutes. You just need... It's great. I actually do. And the players just say, I just need minutes. Just need minutes. Hours. Yeah. Get some hours somewhere. Get some games.
It's better. Yeah. Let's just play some football. Come on.
Lovely. Right. Next up from the delightfully named Ricky Kitchen, who amazingly isn't even the most Keezy named person on Mesut Ozil's this time. He says, fourth officials standing in front of substitutes, stopping them from entering the field until the very moment the player they are replacing has left the pitch. Do they think if they let them on, a team will play with 12? It is, I mean, I hesitate, David Walker, to call fourth officials Jobsworths. but if we were to level that criticism at any stage, it is the little arm across a midriff of a player saying you can't come on yet. It's pathetic. It is pathetic.
It is. Why not let them just run on cross paths as they on and off the pitch? It doesn't make any sense.
It's annoying to look at, Nick, to see that little human barrier being made, a bit like a car park barrier, saying, no, not yet. But can you imagine like as a really sort of substitute, really desperate to get on and change the game, just feeling that firm forearm against your stomach? That must be so annoying.
It's very sort of provincial bouncer behaviour, isn't it? It's also, it's happened to me a couple of times in America when people... If you try and cross the road when the man isn't green, when it's clearly like it's clear you can do that, a couple of times people have genuinely gone, whoa, 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 stop it.
Like jaywalking. Fourth officials.
Yeah, like they're off duty fourth officials. Yeah, stopping me. Someone genuinely did once say, jaywalking's a crime, you know.
Wow.
They've got a fourth official on every street corner in America.
Exactly.
Well, the best thing is when the man does turn green, they tap you on the bum and send you off. On you go. Well, little joke first, and on you go. You're rubbish at crossing roads, aren't you? Yeah.
Checks the studs on my trainers.
Ricky Kitchen's bang on with this, Dave. It is the fundamentally most silly little thing that referees / wider officials do.
I would agree with that. I think there are other examples of them potentially sort of being a bit jobsworthy. And one that I often notice is sometimes if a ball has gone out for a throw-in and it's like right at the linesman's feet, it's almost come to a stop, they just will not nudge it back to the player. Like, what? They'll wait. They will not touch the ball at any point, even if... they'll sometimes get out of the way of it and it will go over, you know, it will go off the pitch and it will take a lot longer. They could have just stop it.
That's weird. Just stop the ball. I know they have a lot on their plate, Nick, with impartiality and, you know, accusations of bias and where they're born and all this nonsense, but just stop the ball with your foot, mate. It's fine.
It feels like it's one of those kind of health and safety things. It's like, well, I can't touch the ball, mate. What if you thought it was going to run and I stop it, and then you stop and you pull your hamstring? You're going to sue me, aren't you? Come on. It's not my fault.
That isn't as outlandish as you might think. But I definitely, you know, they've got to be consistent. You stopped it for them, but you didn't stop it for us, did you?
Imagine.
That's
it would quickly descend into anarchy. But when you see it with your eyes, it does. It's like, come on.
You can imagine a manager actually getting angry with us. Oh, I don't want to say too much, and I don't like to speak about referees, but you know, he did trap it quite nicely as well, actually. Not bad skills, actually. Good observations from Ricky Kitchen there. The third hatred this time round is from George Hall.
One of my hates is over-the-top fan endearment. During the COVID period, you could set your watch to when the commentators sounded obliged to draw. Well, as much as we're enjoying this here, it's nothing without the fans in the ground. Dramatic. We understand it's your game vibe of adverts and trailers. And players or managers on autopilot say that the fans were amazing, regardless if the fans were actually silent or quite abusive.
So this is about kind of over-romanticisation of football fans. Now, Nick, I think there are layers of acceptability to this. The most acceptable... example was during lockdown when we were talking about how sad it was that fans weren't there, because games were rubbish as spectacles, and that was absolutely fine, and it was a reminder of how important 30,000 people were to the spectacle of a football game. That's absolutely fine. The middle layer, as George identifies, is when players and managers kind of make that kind of autopilot reference to fans after games, which it's just becoming more and more insincere, isn't it?
Yeah, has this been cheapened by the kind of knee-jerk post-match social media post. Great fans, didn't get the result we wanted, but we move on kind of thing. You know, bicep emoji. Or, and it often feels like managers will often say it in their post-match press conferences, and it feels like there is often a question, often from a sort of local journalist who just sort of feels a bit sorry for the manager who's lost the game. And they said, well, it's like the question is, well, the team were dog shit, but what about the fans?
Well, I know they were just magnificent as always, weren't they? I mean, they never give up. But, I mean, it's not unheard of, Nick, for managers.
They were screaming, sacked in the morning 10 minutes ago.
Well, I mean, we say this. I mean, I guess it isn't, you know, blanket praise for managers to fans, Dave. There seems to be increasingly amount of kind of snark between managers and sets of fans these days. Managers are definitely getting braver at calling out fan bases.
Well, you know, remiss of me to go back to Watford again, but there we are. Roy Hodgson had a very tetchy relationship with the Watford fans during his brief spell in charge last season. Because I think he was asked, Nick, in a few press conferences and interviews about, you know, have you got any messages for the fans or, you know, and he was basically like, well, not really. I'm just here to do my job and I'm going to do it and I'm not going to pander to the fans. I don't really care what they've got to say. And obviously that went down like a sack of spuds. And then to compound it all, so we're losing games and there was all this sort of slight kind of unease between Hodgson and the fan base anyway. In the game Watford were relegated last season, confirmed, at Selhurst Park.
This was great.
He did a lap of honour around the three sides of the ground where the Crystal Palace fans were, said goodbye to them because he hadn't had the chance in lockdown and didn't walk over to the Watford fans at all. They were furious.
After the match, Roy Hodgson said the away fans were unfortunately a bit too far away. That is an all-time Premier League quote for me. It's so Hodgson as well. There's a hint of knowingness about it, but fundamentally it's underlined by, I don't give a shit what you think.
Yeah,
I mean, presumably the whole thing was underpinned by, look, I know I'm not going to be here in a couple of months. You know I'm not going to be here in a couple of months. Yeah. So fuck you.
Yeah,
basically,
that's absolutely fine. I get that. Mm. There's no point trying to construct this kind of fake relationship with fans when you're not going to be around to endure them any longer.
I agree, but also like just going back to the original sort of point of this selection, I'm on board with the spirit of it, I think. And I think a close cousin of it is language that you get around the EFL, the Football League. It's even the EFL themselves. It's always real football for real fans.
Yeah.
Proper football, proper fans.
Exactly.
What does that even mean?
Well, this takes us into the most unacceptable layer of overdone fan endearment, which is basically marketing speak. Lazy football adjacent marketing speak that really doesn't know any better than to kind of evoke vague concepts of fandom, which I think is just really shit and quite patronising to actual football fans for a start, but also just really lazy and rubbish. It's like, ugh, ooh, you love your club, don't you? You love them. We love them as much as you do. We love window cleaning just as much as you love your club.
Why is Richard Keys voicing this advert?
Times are hard for the.
That sounded like you'd uncovered a recording of Keyesy doing the first draft of that Sean Bean advert. And as a no, because sorry, we're going to have to get someone proper in to do this. Keyesy was rubbish.
Yep. Yeah. Very good. Multi-layered gripe from George Hall there. Thank you for that. Next up comes from Sam. Now, his irritation hate is the specific way the close-ups cameraman run onto the pitch at full time and how close they get to their selected player, usually the man of the match. Chill out. Give them some space. It's the same thing every week. Nick, I think this is one of the sort of things about sort of televised football that I guess we don't really kind of just take for granted. It's just how irritating it must be to have a cameraman in your face, sort of rotating 180 degrees to see every side of your face as you walk off a pitch. Usually when something good happens, but often when something bad has happened too, must be quite annoying. Players don't talk about it.
It feels like the subgenre of this where if there's been a contentious refereeing decision, which there always is, that when the manager comes onto the pitch and sort of approaches the referee, you get this cameraman kind of circling them and goes like, just saying, oh, what's he going to say? Is he going to say something rude to the referee?
It's very cinematic.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you've scored a hat trick, Dave, and you're walking off the pitch and you've got this camera in your face and you've got to do a little grin to the camera and say, Harry Kane's quite good at this, sort of a sheepish kind of gesture to the camera saying, yep, done it, or whatever. But it's kind of new managers in their first game have a camera stuck in their face while they're stood in their technical area, sort of surveying the game that's about to unfold. And they don't really know where to look. And they know that the camera will eventually pan round to hitting them square in the eye, and they're going to have to not look at it. It's the whole thing is just painful. People don't realise how annoying it must be to be a football manager, and this is one of the reasons.
It's quite a skill, really. I wonder if they get training in it from the clubs, whatever. But like, I'm certain that I've made this analogy before when this has come up in a different way in one of the podcasts. But it is similar to when you're at a wedding. Right. And, you know, the photographer is just doing the rounds in the reception and you're standing right there. And all of you know that they're there. You can't look at the camera.
Yeah.
Do I sip the champagne? Do I smile? Do I nod? Like, you don't know what to do. And it's the same sort of thing. But it's obviously it's way more intrusive for because they're doing their job. Yeah. Whatever, and they know that it's on national television, and another, you know, now you've got the spider cam at the a lot of the grounds, and there was a good example of this, like in game on Sunday at the Emirates. I think it was Gabriel Martinelli got injured and like got barged into like the hoardings or something in the second half, and the spider cam just like zoomed right. It was right on top of his head. He was writhing in pain, and there was this camera just
like
sort of
died on Grand Theft Auto.
There was a slightly similar genre after the Christian Bull game. Afterwards Luis Suarez was. He was in floods of tears.
Oh, yes.
And he pulled up his shirt over his head. And Steven Gerrard came over and was comforting him. Then a camera comes up to him. Gerrard pushed the camera, did that thing where he put his hand in the face of the camera.
It's a brave
and
job, isn't
pushed
it?
Pushed it away. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, have a bit of respect, guys. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
This is a sensitive moment.
Sometimes you do get, I mean, that's obviously jackpot for the camera people. Wayne Rooney. In the 2010, was it 2010 World Cup?
Yeah.
When he's like, nice, isn't it? Your own fans booing you. Yeah. And
that was Loro.
Hi, Loro.
And there was one in the last World Cup where Morocco's Nordin Amrabat, he did like the VAR. He like spelt VAR.
Oh, yeah.
With his finger.
VAR is bullshit or something like that. Yeah. It's amazing. It's a portal to the rest of the world. Use it. They're not just furniture. Use that cameraman.
But we also, as I mentioned, that Liverpool season, we wouldn't have got the "this does not slip" if it hadn't been for one of these very intrusive cameramen just kind of sticking the camera in the
post-match
huddle.
Oh, yeah, when you hear as well.
Yeah, that, yeah, yeah.
That's the inner circle, quite literally, of the huddle, Liverpool. Yeah, so they're doing a brave job. They're like war reporters, really, you know, frontline cameramen. They're probably
jackets.
The same. They're probably like veterans from the Gulf War or something who are now in the Premier League saying, yeah, well, it's pretty easy for me. I was in Baghdad in 91. So, yeah, fine. Final hatred of football comes from the most Keynesian name of all. This is Chris Garthwaite.
My hate is the last 5 minutes of halftime when you're at the match. If you're chatting with friends, you've run out of first half analysis by that point. If you bought a pint, you're drinking it far quicker than you would like. And even the on-pitch entertainment, the last refuge of the bored matchgoer, has come to an end. Just get the players back out on the pitch and save us from this hell.
This is so, so good, Dave. The concept of a 15-minute half-time is so cast iron. I mean, apparently, up in Scotland, it was 10 minutes for a bit, and they sort of expanded it back to 15 quite recently as well, but that's by the by. 15 minutes of half-time is, and regardless of whether you're at the stadium or watching on TV, is such a very defined amount of time. First five, you're switched off. You're kind of absorbing what has just happened. The next five, that is smack bang. You are now absorbing the analysis of the first half and you're really reflecting on what's happened and you're ready to go again. The third 5 minutes of half-time are bullshit. Like, complete bullshit. Shouldn't exist. They are the most annoying 5 minutes of my life.
And the whole situation is exacerbated by the fact that you can't get any phone signal. You can't get any 4G, so you can't even just idly scroll through Twitter or check the scores from the other games. Yeah, completely. And the bit about the pints as well is just, it's bang on the money, because I don't believe that there's anyone that's ever had an enjoyable pint of beer in a football stadium in this country, especially at half time.
Particularly at half time. You can't, because, I'm just very impressed that he's managed to get a pint within the 15 minutes of half time. And I think it's ever happened to me at a football game, yeah, with any kind of any large crowd anyway.
Without getting up early. Which kind of brings into that's a whole other thing of like, how early is too early to get up for half time? At what moment do you go? Are you still what you're still watching the game, sort of as you gingerly go down the stairs and all that sort of thing?
And that last 5 minutes is where you really start to feel the cold in the winter months as well. It's like, can you just get the fuck on with it? Come on, out you come. And you look at your watch. This is crucial to the phenomenon, Dave. You look at your watch and it'll be like, it'll be 3:58, and you think, well, that's two more minutes, but it won't be, because they will be at like 4:03.
Yeah, because they didn't, because the game, they didn't go in. Yeah, exactly.
And you,
and,
but you know that in your head, and you're sort of working out again, well, I've got to allow a couple of minutes for the injury time, and then of course they went back in again.
And just, if you're made worse as well, if you're a season ticket holder, as I am at the moment, and I'm a new season ticket holder for this season, so the relationship with the guy on my left is still in its early stages, and we can chat. We can chat about the game. We can have a little bit of, oh, what do you think about that and this? But it's different if you're with a mate, like a proper mate, or maybe with your dad or your son or daughter, whatever.
Yeah, you're not talking about the game in those last 5 minutes. You're talking about life. So, well, yeah, I might go there on Tuesday, actually, yeah.
But if you're with someone who you don't know, it's just, well, you just sort of have to just, what do you do? Just both sort of stare into the distance.
Yeah, I think I've had nothing left to say. Really. Yeah, I think, oh, well, yeah, it's difficult though, because you don't want to hand your notice in, because you want, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, I'm thinking of doing something else, to be honest. This is the sort of conversations that definitely happen in the last 5 minutes of half times, Nick. It's moved away from football completely. It's just like, yeah, I don't know, I think I'm done with her, to be honest.
it's a hell of a thing to launch. That's quite a big thing to launch into in the last sort of few minutes of a game. It's like a former colleague once in the space of a lift journey, in response to the question, "You're right, mate," he said, "Yeah, I think I'm going to leave my wife." I said, Jesus, all right. Well, there isn't really time to finish this conversation properly. No, absolutely not.
That's not a lift conversation, but you could definitely do it standing on the terraces. 3:58 p.m. No question about that. Chris Garthwaite, if there was such a thing, you win entry of the month, because that is absolutely fantastic. The last 5 minutes of a halftime break.
It also feels like when you're, maybe this is an indictment of my productivity levels, but it feels like when you're watching a game at home, it feels like it's an amount of time that is just long enough to make you think you can complete a task.
Yeah,
but it's not actually long enough to complete that task.
You're absolutely right. Try and do anything during halftime of a televised game, you will miss the start of the second half. And that's the absurd time-space continuum that is halftime. It's too long, it's too short, nobody knows what to do with themselves.
I had a shower in halftime of the Super Sunday.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Ridiculous. The speed that you had, how vigorously were you drying yourself at the end of this shower? Well, Gotta get back.
I had to poke my head around the bathroom door, which is the next room to the TV, and I was like, what are they going to be kicking off? And we were in an ad break. It was brilliant.
Oh, I can't believe it. I feel like I barely know you anymore. Anyway, but I do feel like I know our listeners a lot better after that. Thanks for allowing us to delve into your collective psyches. That was Mesut Haaland-Dix with the listeners for October. We'll be back, probably not next month because of the old World Cup, but back soon. Thanks everyone for listening. See you next time.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.